Open as a subcommittee and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 983. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I'll just testify briefly because there are a lot of good people to testify behind me. Not that I'm not a good person, but you know, you got to watch the way you put your sentences together. Mr. Chair, I just want to give you a little tortured history about this bill, and it shouldn't have been tortured, but it ended up being that way. It was introduced as Senate Bill 828 last session. It passed the Senate with 24 aye votes and went over to the House, and I got into a little snit with the House chair over there.
Is that a legislative term, Senator?
Yes. Yes, that would be a legislative term.
Okay.
And so that bill sat there for a while, and we tried to amend it into different bills. And so then we found one over in the Senate. I borrowed Senator Starr's bill, Senate Bill 655, and we sent it back over again, this time with 26 aye votes. And Representative Doyle didn't like it for a little while. Well, finally, we got everybody on board. Representative Doyle liked it, and it was on the third reading list, on the third reading calendar on August 27th, and guess what happened, Mr. Chair?
We got to go home.
We got to go home, and my bill was over there, and I pleaded and I begged with the Senate President, as did many other people who had bills hanging on the other side, but we had to go home, and so here we are. In the meantime, the PUC, the Public Utility Commission, did a few things to help resolve the matter, but I still think we need the legislation to take care of it. What this bill does, Senate Bill 923, I think is the title of it. 983 this session. You know, we throw these bill numbers around. It authorizes the Public Utility Commission to establish a judicial certification program to help ensure that survivors of domestic violence and other abusive situations can access basic telephone service. This is really important for victims of domestic violence when they leave abusive situations. And it's similar to a VINE program we have a VINE program for when people get out of prison, then they call the abuser or the victim and let the victim know that the offender is now out of prison and give them an opportunity to have telephone service. And this bill is just a darn good bill. And like I said, all these other folks are here behind me to talk about it. And hopefully it will not have such a tortured little history this session. And, Mr. Chair, I would urge your aye vote.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Walker before we let her go on? Okay, thank you.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. I'll run off to Judiciary and be back to join you on another bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Cheryl O'Neill, Denise Washington, and Jeff Bissonette, if you want to come forward. We have four people signed up to testify on this bill, all in support, so. Welcome.
Thank you. Should I go first? You can ask her. Well, I think I'll start.
Okay.
Chairman Metzger and Senators, thank you for letting us have the chance to talk to you about this bill today. I think I'm starting because I'm kind of the one who kind of set the ball rolling on this whole issue a long time ago. My name is Cheryl O'Neill, and I live just outside of Junction City in Lane County. I was an advocate at Windspace at the time when I started bringing up this concern, and I had been working at that. I'm now the executive director there, but I had been working at the domestic violence clinic where we represented people in court for protective orders, restraining orders, and stalking orders. And a woman came to me, one of the many people who came for our services, and the particular, she had a restraining order, she had it in effect, we were able to protect that order for her, but she wasn't able to get a telephone connected for her new residence, because, you know, many people actually cannot remain, of course, in the same residence that they've been living, and they need to establish a new residence when they have the situation happen. And what happened for her was there was a bill, an overdue bill on the phone, And she wanted to enter, you know, she was offering to enter into a payment plan so that she could pay off her overdue bill and have access to a phone. And they wouldn't, that was not an offer that they were willing to accept at that point. And I even at that point called and spoke with the supervisor. And the supervisor told me, well, that's illegal. You know, we can't do that. And I was kind of puzzled. I didn't understand why they couldn't do a payment plan with her and let her actually have a phone. And I was worried about her because she was in a location that she didn't know anybody. I mean, we did quite a bit of safety planning, you know, like okay, you don't have a phone, but if something should happen, you know, what do we do? You know, what's our backup plan? And it was really difficult. She didn't know anybody. She didn't know any neighbors. There was nobody she was could speak to if something had happened. And anyway, I was worried about her, and I talked with some of the lawyers there about this statement that it was illegal, and they said no, it was not illegal. In fact, there were these ways we could try to get that to happen, which I was very excited about. So I was going to talk with her the next week, and that weekend, her abusive partner came to the home and raped her and killed himself in front of her, and I never got to talk to her again. And she didn't have a phone. And it just has bugged me ever since, pretty intensely bothered me. And as I was working there, I noticed there were some other incidents that arose. One woman, same situation, couldn't pay off, couldn't enter into a payment plan to pay off her phone. Ex-husband came, broke into the house, broke her nose. You know, she had to take her two kids and, you know, run next door because she didn't have a phone in order to, you know, call the police. And then there was another incident where we actually were able to finally, we did a lot of things to try to solve this problem. I got pretty manic about it. And then, you know, I was talking to somebody finally in Colorado who was part of the phone company, and they would try to work out a deal with me if I had a client. And so I finally got something, brokered this deal for this one person so they had a phone, which was great. And the advantages of that were not just that greater safety. They were also advantages in the fact that this person then had connection with all of the different resources that they needed to reestablish their life. The woman was able to get a job. It made her job search much easier. Her daughter had seen the abusive partner had like chopped up her daughter's cat, and the daughter had seen that, and it was very emotionally, you know, disturbing. And she was able to, you know, have some emergency phone calls with her counselor, things like that. That, you know, a phone line can be really important both for the 911 but for other resources as well. The reason I'm going into all this is because it also was the start of our local 911 collecting phones. You know, being able to get the cell phone because we found out, you know, through a kind of a convoluted process that a cell phone would work at least to call 911, so we started collecting and distributing those old cell phones, which we're still doing, and that's great. It's a great step. But the cell phone has a couple of limitations which are pretty serious. One is, me, for example, I live out in a rural area. I can't use the cell phone where I live. I mean, I have one, but I'd have to drive for 5 miles before I could get access to 911 if I was relying on a cell phone. And there's a lot of rural area. Our county alone is the size of the state of Connecticut. So, you know, a lot of people living out there who aren't going to be able to, the cell phone's just not going to provide the kind of safety we'd like. And then the other factor is that, you know, if you have a cell phone, it only calls 911. You know, this example of this young girl being able to access services, or this woman being able to, you know, get into some employment, that would not happen with just that cell phone thing. So the point of this bill, I think, is pretty limited. We're not asking free phones or anything like that. We're just asking for the survivors to have an opportunity to enter into a payment plan so that they can establish a phone for that safety line. And this is already allowed when people have medical, you know, you can do the medical exception. It's already allowed. So that was the route we first took, was through the administrative route. And we sometimes people can get it through their doctor, but it's a little odd. They go to their doctor, they have, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome, so they get the letter saying it's a medical concern and they need to have a phone. It's a little convoluted, you know. It's still, if you have a restraining order, you've gone through a legal process, you have, or a stalking order, some kind of protective order. You have had judicial review, you know, you've had to present a case and it's been accepted. And it seems like a pretty, you know, it's a pretty good process for basing a kind of an exception like that on, especially when it's not like a giveaway. It's really just a payment plan. If they don't keep up with their payments, they still lose access to their phone. So I think it's fairly reasonable, and it provides a great deal, you know, a great deal of safety for people. So I'm just really hoping that we can get it through this time. That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lundell. Let's go ahead and go with Ms. Washington.
Chair Metzger, Vice Chair Starr, and members of the Business and Economic Development Committee. Good afternoon. My name is Denise Washington, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. OCADSB, much shorter name, was established in 1978, and it's a statewide network of domestic violence and sexual assault programs, community partners, and organizations that work together to end domestic violence and sexual assault in our state. OCADSB supports Senate Bill 983 as one of the many facets necessary to craft a coordinated community response to address violence against women. We appreciate this effort and the ongoing support the Oregon Legislature has demonstrated for programs, service providers, and ultimately survivors in the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 983 would prohibit termination of local residential phone service if it would endanger a person who is at risk of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, or elder person with disabilities abuse. Retaining local phone service can be critical to reach out in times of crisis. It will make it easier for victims and their children to get the help they need. Please feel free to contact me or the coalition if you need any additional information. We appreciate you for your commitment to ending violence against women and children, and we look forward to continuing to work with you to address this most urgent social problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Mr. Bissonnette, and then we'll have any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of utilities, including telecommunication utilities. And I just want to say real quick that we do indeed support Senate Bill 983. A couple of things that we'll just I'll highlight real quickly and then end. There are very specific sort of legal definitions that somebody applying for this sort of judicial certification has to meet, and you'll find those specifically listed in the bullet points about the middle of the page of the fact sheet that was handed out with Women's Space and Cub logo at the top of the page. Also, this is to establish basic telephone service so that a survivor has a dial tone in the home. This does not count for call waiting. It doesn't count for call forwarding. A lot of this stuff, it is for a dial tone in the home. And all a telecommunication utility is required to do is work out a payment plan or to grant telephone service without a deposit. And work out some sort of payment plan if needed. This is crafted very quickly or very closely on the existing medical certification plan. Has been working very well for many years, and it's also very important to note that if for some reason the survivor can't meet the agreement that they've worked out and they haven't worked in good faith with the phone company, service can then be shut off. But I can say that in the medical certification, the phone companies are very good at sort of working with folks and kind of keeping a continuing dialogue going, and we expect this to operate the same way. So again, I would appreciate your aye vote on Senate Bill 983. Would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for any of our panelists? I think a lot of us are familiar with this legislation from before. No questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our last testimony is Sybil Hebb. If I said that wrong, it looks like an H-E-B-B, but... Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Metzger and members of the committee, I'll be very brief. I have only support to add. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm from the Oregon Law Center. I'm the legislative lobbyist for them. The Law Center is a provider of civil legal assistance to low-income Oregonians, and we prioritize, among other things, service to people who have been victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking, and from, and it's on behalf of those clients of ours that we that I speak today, and I can just tell you that a number of clients that we see come through our office are significantly hampered in their efforts to achieve safety and or to reach out to other services if they do not have access to a phone, and that's been a consistent barrier that we have identified. So we're very supportive of the bill and grateful for your time on the issue.
Thank you, Ms. Hebb. So just to kind of capture the essence here, because it does appear to be the identical bill we passed last year, is that we're actually following the medically needy program that we currently have. And on page 2 of the bill, section 5, clearly articulates that they have to pay for the service. This is not a free service. It allows them to enter into a payment agreement, and that can be severed if they don't do that. But it's to ensure that they have that service available to them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
We're going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 983, and it would be my desire to open a work session on Senate Bill 983.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
No amendments on this bill?
No amendments.
I move Senate Bill 983 to the Senate floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 983 to the floor for due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes.
Yes. Senator Juana Sanderson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why hasn't any of the telecommunication people testified? What is their Quest or Verizon, or do they have any?
Well, would one of them like to come up and say something? Miss Lang is so nice to defer to others.
Make him Rochambeau.
Well,
hello.
Verizon.
Welcome.
Asked about. So I'm Shelley Jensen, government affairs manager for Verizon. We don't have any problem with the bill as long as it follows the procedures that we already have in place for the medical emergency. That's we're fine with it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion? Okay, the motion is to send Senate Bill 983 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. No other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Let's have Senator Walker carry the bill since she took the time to initiate that again. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 390. And I have one person set to testify, and that's the person who would like to be on the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission, Labor Commissioner Dan Gardner. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We promise this is a SNP-free bill. So, But anyway, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And Senate Bill 390 actually is a bill that would be a benefit to Oregon. It's an ideal opportunity for us to support our community, businesses, and working families as we maximize Oregon's ability to sustain and strengthen our economic growth. What this bill would do is allow the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to be on the Oregon Economic and Development Commission. As Labor Commissioner, I have the responsibilities of all Oregon employees and employers, and to ensure that labor law is enforced fairly and uniformly across the state. In dealing face-to-face with hundreds of employees and employers across the state, I believe that I have a unique and first-hand perspective to be able to contribute to the work of the Commission and my perspective in setting policy to evaluate the viability of proposed economic projects, especially through what we have in the Apprenticeship and Training Division. The Apprenticeship and Training Division, we have over 150 different apprenticeship programs across the state in 44 different occupations. It's been my firm belief that Oregon Economic Development Commission workforce and apprenticeship and training need to work in a much more collaborative fashion to help to create more opportunities for a trained workforce across the state. And as one who's traveled the state, I've been and frequently visit many of the 36 counties across the state, and actually have done job shadowing in more than 50 different occupations. I think that it's an excellent opportunity to help to bring the Oregon Economic and Development Commission together with our apprenticeship and training programs and add a new perspective and a new voice to the commission. I certainly appreciate the committee's consideration of the matter and urge your support of Senate Bill 390.
Thank you, Commissioner Gardner. Any questions for Commissioner Gardner?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Moniz Anderson.
Right now, the members of the commission, the only criteria, really not more than three, can be belong to one political party, but it says at least one member shall be an individual with substantial experience of training in international trade, and that's it. Right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, that's my understanding, yes.
And so who is on it now? Who do they represent? Do you know the members now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I can certainly get that information to you. I was when I initially put this bill in a couple of years ago, I could answer that question. I have not checked as of late.
Is it primarily business people or...
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, that's my understanding, is that mostly they come from a more business background, yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 390, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 671. And, colleagues, you have a dash 2 amendment on Senate Bill 671, and I will ask Teresa maybe just to give us the overview, and then we'll have an explanation of what it actually does. But okay. Well, all right. That's honest. So
I've only been able to read halfway through Senate.
It is very complex. So why don't we ask Kevin Campbell, Dave Barrows, and Bob Lance to come forward. And I'll ask one of you to do that overview for the members. Yeah. That's okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. For the record, my name's Kevin Campbell, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Mutual Utility Development, Inc. Our purpose today is to briefly overview an approach to dealing with the PGE challenge that's before the state currently, and to talk specifically about how the Dash 2 amendments fit in with that. I do want to mention that we haven't had an opportunity to review the details of the amendment. We did send down language, so we participated in the initial part of that, but haven't had a chance to look at it since then, and so we will probably not be going into great detail, although we will be able to answer questions as you have them.
Okay, one thing I might do, Mr. Campbell, just for colleagues here, 671, as written, was a compilation of different elements that we had from our previous discussion. And the amendment to 672 that we just received from council seeks to essentially replace the bill by including the UM 1011 net benefit standard for those who wish to take over a public utility. And the other element would be the inclusion of the principal concept before us of a mutual utility. I mean, those are the two elements that are now comprised of the amendment to Senate Bill 671-2. So, just as an overview, and we have had the net benefits discussion with others, and we may have one more comment on that today, but we'll confine yours to at least the principle, if not the detail, of the Dash 2 amendment that comprises your recommendation. Okay.
Great. Thank you very much. With me today is Dave Barrows. You're familiar with Dave. He's also working with me on this project. And Bob Lance, he's the former VP, Corporate Finance, the Treasurer, and the Chief Investment Officer of Pacific Corp, so has some significant experience in the whole utility industry. This group that is forwarding an option is a group of individuals that are PGE customers, and they're also utility executives with experience in kind of a wide range, everything from the utility itself to accounting, to finance. They have a pretty good team of folks put together. And like many of you have, in the face of uncertainty with PGE, moved forward, taken leadership, like many of you have, to try to address or to take control or to provide options which are in the best interest of the citizens of the state of Oregon. And we believe this is an option that deserves some consideration, and we'd like you to favorably consider it. What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is just talk about the basic concept of what they're trying to do with PGE and then how this amendment connects with that. The approach is a mutual ownership approach to the purchase of PGE, wherein the PGE customer would be the owner. The way this would happen, or the key advantages of this whole proposal, is that the headquarters in this case would remain in Oregon, which is a key concern to many. The PUC would continue to regulate this utility and, in fact, would have to approve this idea before it could even move forward. So that's an important benefit. There would be no Bonneville preference power, which is how it is currently with PGE, but I know there's folks concerned about that. PGE, in this case, would pay property tax, state income tax, and franchise fees. And so this is, in some ways, has many benefits associated with it as it moves forward. The profit for this entity in the past could go to shareholders. It could be distributed out. In this case, of course, the money would stay in the state. It would be available for reinvestment in PGE to make sure that the utility itself is a healthy utility moving forward. That's one of the concerns we have with the potential for shares to be distributed, where the control of the entity may go to someone that's more interested in profit than taking care of the utility itself. There would also be then in that profit the amount at the end of the day that would be available to be returned to customers. And that would have to be designed, of course, but in a rate credit or something similar. The whole plan then is to keep control within the state. There would be a board of directors. I think it's a 9-person board at this point that's envisioned, 5 of which will be PGE customers. These will all be leaders in the utility industry. And so what I'd like to do now, that was this very basic concept. The bill itself adds a level of security and efficiency to this approach, because what it does is it basically binds the PUC to a tariff that customers would pay, in essence, to purchase the company. The PUC can do that today, but they can't bind future PUCs to that tariff on the bill. The reliability or the security of that makes sure that lenders for the purchase of this are assured that there's a secure financing stream into the future. And what the result of this is ultimately is that with that secure funding base for lenders, you get a better bond rating, AAA bond rating, and the lowest interest rates possible, which in this case, again, spells savings back to the customer again, because that's where those dollars ultimately find their home. At this point, what I'd like to do is like to turn it over to Bob Lance. He is by far the expert, and so now he can correct me where I went off the trail and can go into additional detail and can probably talk more about the heart of this effort as well. So with your permission, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Welcome, Mr. Lance.
Thank you for allowing us to be here with you today. The basic concept we have here...
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Robert F. Lance. I'm a citizen of Oregon for the last 30 years. I live in Lake Oswego, and I'm the president and chief executive officer of Oregon Mutual Utility Development Corporation. Kevin did a wonderful job summarizing what we are about and what we can hope to achieve for the customers of the state of Oregon. This is a rather novel concept in two respects. One is that it's a mutual utility, which is unknown on the face of the earth as far as we can determine. At least we haven't been able to find anybody's footprints in the snow for us to follow. We'll probably have the legal bills to prove that eventually. The other thing is that it will be using a securitization concept, which is very well known within the utility industry and has been a method of financing stranded assets that have been stranded by deregulation. For example, Pacific Gas and Electric just last month issued over $2 billion of securitization bonds at a cost of LIBOR plus 2 basis points, which comes in probably less than 3%. We feel with the AAA rating that we'll be able to save Oregon customers at least $100 million over what we could finance traditionally with a bridge financing, that would be similar to what a parent of a utility might be able to achieve with banks, institutional investors. So there's that benefit to the customers as well. We believe that this concept, what you're looking at here in the bill, will not prevent other efforts to keep PGE local. That's what the primary purpose of our effort was in light of Texas Pacific Group and the storm and furor that have come out of the proceedings with Texas Pacific over the last 6 to 9 months. However, now that Texas Pacific has been denied approval by the Public Utility Commission, and even if they do not appeal that order, we feel that the distribution of stock to an unknown set of investors, the creditors of Enron, could be a greater evil in the future. So we're not trying to circumvent either the city's approach nor the state power authority, Senator Deckert's approach, by keeping PGE local. We're just trying to provide another way for a local Oregonian organization to make an offer to the trustee and keep PGE local. So that's what we're about, and if you have any questions, we'll be glad to answer them.
Yes, Senator Atkinson.
Greater evil? What did you mean by that?
Greater evil.
You just said, did I hear you correctly, you said something was a greater evil?
I don't think.
Referring to Enron? Am I the only one that heard that? What did you mean by that?
I don't remember saying that, so...
Chair Metzger, Senator Atkinson, I think what he was trying to say is that the distribution of shares provides a continued level of uncertainty regarding PGE's status in the state, and then in fact, if the folks that received shares under this scenario and the control of PGE was eventually dissipated, that local control, that you may end up with folks that didn't treat that utility so much as a utility as it was an asset or a funding source that could be handled in a number of different ways. So, did that answer the question?
Fine. Is there another question before we move on? Yes, Senator Decker.
Senator Atkinson. thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lanz, and obviously Mr. Campbell and Mr. Barrows, thank you. And really appreciate the effort to keep PGE local and the energy and the time that I know you must have put in on a complex undertaking. If I could just ask a couple of questions, and I haven't had the benefit of sitting down, and it's my fault. Y'all attempted to sit down with me and walk me through at least the initial, and I had to cancel that meeting. So if I could just ask two or three questions.
Please do.
Just on the tariff, Mr. Lanz, what would the, and I'm just trying to sort through, I guess it's the, for lack of a better word, the net benefit standard that the PUC, that I think all of us also have, is just what is the net benefit to ratepayer? And so the tariff idea, which is unique and novel and I'm not familiar with, how would that manifest itself on customer bills? And do you know what a ballpark that tariff would be or fee that ratepayers would pay?
Well, it depends on a number of variables. Depends on what the ultimate purchase price will have to pay in order to get the PGE stock from the trustee. That at this current level is somewhat of a bargain in many analysts' minds at a little over $1 billion. PGE has appreciated in value over the last 12 months and could be as much as $1.5 or $2 billion by the time the bidding process gets completed. So that's one variable. Another variable would be how long a period do we want to amortize the cost over, just as you would with your home select a mortgage maturity of 15 years or 30 years. You would have a lower monthly payment with the 30-year option than the 15-year option, although you might wind up paying more eventually. So that's another choice that we have to look at. Much will depend upon when we get to that stage and what the Public Utility Commission authorizes us. And we also have to vet this with a number of the industrial customers, the large industrial customers, and see what their preferences are. But in the long term, the amount of acquisition financing will replace the cost of equity in a capital structure for Portland General Electric. The cost of equity now for PGE is probably approaching, or at least testimony would be given, in a contested rate proceeding, probably looking at a cost of 11 or 12%. With interest rates going up, it could be well be higher than that. Whereas the debt that will be created with this will ultimately replace that equity and lower the cost of money, which is approximately 30% of the cost of running a utility right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree. The interest rate is obviously one of the key driving factors. It's obviously the core of getting that low interest rate on the acquisition.
If it's designed correctly and meets the rating agency's requirements, and our language tries to incorporate language that was acceptable in the states of New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, some of the large, California, some of the larger jurisdictions where this has been accepted. So we've tried to keep to those same kind of things, substantially the same language that we know will be acceptable to Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch's, so that we'll be able to get that AAA rating.
Mm-hmm. So do they have a tariff or a... I'm trying to picture what a PGE bill would look like to its customers, and there would just be a line on there, a charge. And if you used, I guess, TPG's bargaining price for the utility, I'm trying to get a sense of just how high or low that tariff fee would be. I don't know if you're there yet or can at least give customers some level of knowledge of on the average residential or average industrial what that might look like. I think it'd be helpful, and perhaps you're just not there yet in terms of what that figure would be.
Well, I'd be reluctant to give that number right now, since it's just too early in the process to say, and we don't want to be stuck with a 10% number or a 5% number. We do think it will be significant, however.
So it would be significant. Okay. Just one question on the governance structure. How do y'all comprise? I did note when Kevin said five would be PGE customers, four would be up to. How would those be comprised, or how would the board be put together?
Well, we want to try to have a representation of the entire constituency of Portland General Electric's customers and their stakeholders, not just their customers necessarily. We want to have more representation from the environmental interests. We want to have some more ability for organized labor to be a part of the decision-making process at the utility. I think this gives us an opportunity to expand on the basic investor-owned utility board, which had primarily responsibility to, as fiduciary responsibility to the investors, as opposed to the entire stakeholders within PGE's service territory.
And, Mr. Chair, thank you. And just on the liabilities, have y'all grappled with how you would handle the whether it's the decommissioning of Trojan or the other liabilities that PGE also has? And I haven't had a chance, obviously, to read the language in here. I'm sure it probably actually isn't addressed in this statute.
Well, we would stand in the shoes of PGE as it currently stands. We're trying to preserve as much of the investor-owned utility as possible, including their management. That's why we've decided to, unlike a cooperative, we want to be subject to the Public Utility Commission's jurisdiction. Most of us have investor-owned backgrounds, and we're very familiar with working with the Public Utility Commission and look forward to doing that in the future.
And I guess the last question is just in terms of I guess where I began in terms of keeping rates low or trying to get rate reduction. Obviously, what we've been looking at is the lack of federal or state taxes, the low interest rates, not having the PUC and not having to pay those fees to the PUC. Where does I guess this proposal weigh in on that area of ability to perhaps lower rates for customers?
Well, I think the cost of the Public Utility Commission is not just a monetary cost. I think you get value for your money.
I agree.
I think that the Public Utility Commission is a group of not just the commissioners themselves, but a staff that has a great deal of expertise in providing safe and reliable service. So it's not just deciding how a rate spread should be done. So I think they will provide value in the future, particularly if it gets to be somewhat of a refereeing concept, trying to keep the industrial customers and residential customers and the commercial customers all fairly treated instead of, you know, swinging one way or the other. What was the rest of your question?
Federal taxes.
We'll continue to pay federal taxes, and we won't have phantom taxes as some of the predecessor companies have, because we won't have a parent company that will be able to collect our taxes and then shield them with some other unrelated activities.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the explanation.
Before I go to Senator Walker, I did have a few questions myself. I want to go back to what Senator Decker was asking about the governance model and your envisionment for that. That's an important part, I think, in any of the proposals that we've heard, is the governance model and, you know, how this board would be selected. Can you give me your more detailed thoughts on that?
Well, we are going to announce probably early next week who the initial three people who will be serving on the board, and I think you'll be pleased with that selection. They're prominent Oregonians. They all have some utility experience and business experience, as well as some political experience. As an investor-owned utility, you used to have a proxy process that went through to elect various members of the board of directors. A nominating committee would get together. And quite honestly, over the past times, it may have led to some incestuous relationships, a little bit of cronyism. But our process will be much more open than that. It will allow for the customers to select the members of the board of directors eventually. We'll have not only a board of directors, but we'll have an advisory board as well, which will allow a wider constituency of people to participate in the governance. And it'll be as open as we can possibly make it.
And then following up on that, because I'm trying to picture your model as a mutual company, and so as a mutual, I think of that as being owned by those who are the receiving the service from whatever that organization is. And in this case, you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of ratepayers. And if I'm in a mutual company with, you know, Mass Mutual or something else, I've got weighted ownership. So in terms of how I'm going to elect the board of directors, my little shares don't really buy much. And I'm thinking in terms of creating this new model that you would, you know, present to the PUC for approval is to, is each ratepayer under your idea of governance, would each ratepayer have, you know, equal weighting in terms of voting for these other members of the board of directors? I'm just trying to get a feel for how this would
be. Our initial concept is that each meter will have a vote,
mm-hmm.
so that a residential customer will have probably one vote, whereas a larger industrial customer may have 10 or 12 votes, a commercial customer might have two or three. So that's what we're looking at as far as the kind of sharing of responsibility.
Okay, and then the final thing, and I'll go to questions from other members from the committee, but in this model, and I'd like to maybe make a comparison based on your professional experience, is that unlike another utility that would, or a TPG that would come in with their own capital or at least create capital elsewhere to purchase assets and operations, your that capital is, no one's putting capital into this thing, they're taking it, they're basically through the mutual process having each of the ratepayers through a surcharge or something on their bills, you know, provide the capital for their mutual ownership. And I'd be curious as to your analysis, your opinion in terms of if you're a ratepayer, you're a customer of this utility, as to why you would believe that this model is better for the customer than, say, the City of Portland model or the one that Senator Deckard is working on. Give me your analysis of why you think this would be a net benefit for customers.
Well, let me just talk about the benefits I feel that our mutual concept has without comparing them directly to what the City or Senator Deckard's model might have. And as a customer of the mutual utility, I'll be able to have local control. I'll be able to control the governance of the operation. Recognizing, however, that as a customer, I'm going to be the one that's ultimately paying for ownership, whether it be by the city of Portland, whether it be by the Oregon statewide approach, or Texas Pacific. That's one of the things that first triggered us into thinking about this was Kelvin Davis at Texas Pacific Group saying that Oregonians don't have the ability to come up with the capital to finance the acquisition of Portland General Electric. And this is after he had gotten the Oregon Investment Council to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in the partnership, as well as recognizing that all of the financing options ultimately have to be paid through the fare box, if you will, that the customers are the ones that are going to have to provide the cash flow for no matter what form of ownership you have. So that's one of the things that the customers know worse off with this approach than they would be with some of the others. We do think that they're better off in the long run than with having another investor-owned utility coming in that may be occasioned by the distribution of stock to the Enron creditors, because they'll probably have an initial public offering eventually. There may be an opportunity for another player to come into the state and buy the Portland General Electric stock and take the money out of the state eventually. So I think we're benefiting customers not only as customers but as Oregonians as well.
Okay, thank you. Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, a couple of questions have raised in my mind. The first one is that this last process was very lengthy, as you well know. And if I'm not mistaken, Enron's been in bankruptcy for some time, and I think it's a liquidating Chapter 11. The court doesn't let those cases go on for a long period of time. They need to clear their docket because they get orders from up above that says to clear their docket. So given that, and also given that, Mr. Lance, you testified there's never been a mutual utility before, this would be setting precedent in the country, how do you think you're going to get from point A to point Z in a short period of time that will satisfy the court as well as the PUC?
Well, I think that the process that Texas Pacific Group has gone through with the Public Utility Commission has aired a lot of these issues and answered a lot of the questions. The Public Utility Commission probably, with the next application that comes before them, would not take the extended amount of time that it normally would. Matter of fact, I believe that they can even approve a merger application within 19 days. Not that that's ever been done, but they do have the ability statutorily to be able to take prompt action as quickly as they would like. With this bill that we're proposing be passed, it will make AAA financing available quickly, and with that kind of a tool, we feel that we can expedite matters fairly quickly in obtaining financing. There's no doubt that we'll be able to finance this with the AAA debt or even with the bridge financing if that becomes necessary.
May I follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. Have you made contact with the bankruptcy trustee in the case?
We have attempted to. We've had some just very brief discussions, but this whole process has been shrouded by conflicts of interest and secrecy and things of that sort, so that we've even tried to talk to Portland General Electric with the management there, and they have... They're not able to carry on a dialogue until this process is completed. Even though we have been working ourselves on this project for 7 or 8 months, it's only become recently unveiled because of our concern about violating conflicts of interest or interfering with deals that have already been struck, tortious interference, whatever the lawyers call it. So,
Mr. Chair, I have just one other question. Thank you. you know, I've heard of mutualizing a state accident insurance fund. Nevada did that. It would have been nice if Oregon would have chosen to do that. But, you know, we're going to work with what we've got, and they're cleaning it up. So I know that you can mutualize state-owned assets. You can mutualize other things. I'm just a little concerned that you can get it all done in a short period of time to satisfy regulators as well as legislators, because this is new ground. And I wish you well, but I think 19 days is pretty optimal, sir.
Maybe 3 weeks.
All right. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Mata Sanders.
Explain again the tax situation. You said that you would be paying state and federal tax. City-owned and state-owned, those plans would not pay taxes because they're state and local-owned. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Yeah, we would be paying property taxes as PGE has been obligated to. We would be paying franchise taxes, and we would be paying federal income taxes at whatever the federal income tax allows us to.
And that would be, I guess I'm asking to be comparing, but with Senator Deckert, that would not be the case with your bill at this point.
I feel like I should go down to the witness stand.
I know.
Senator Mons Anderson, the way the public corporation law is constructed is it would not pay federal nor state income tax. And the language then is that all those benefits of those taxes, and they're considerable, very considerable, and when you take the aggregate, all go to the ratepayers. And so it's one of the, when you're looking at ratepayers, it's one of the things that you can construct to benefit ratepayers.
One of the issues, just and we'll go to Mr. Barrels, is that, and again, I have no idea these figures for any of these, but since this would be acquired basically through debt finance by the ratepayers, you know, it would be interesting to see a potential calculation, because there'll be significant debt to offset any profits. But let's go to Mr. Barrels, and you make whatever comments you want, and then.
Mr. Lance,
you passing? Okay. Mr. Lance, go ahead.
Because that is being done right now.
Now, what is your question again?
See, he thought he was already. I was talking about. In terms of the federal tax question that Senator Mata Sanderson mentioned.
Oh.
And under just federal taxation rules, you're going to have considerable debt that would be, I would seem would offset perhaps operating income.
Yeah. Whatever it is, eventually the customers will get the benefit of that and not some third party.
Okay, now Mr. Barrels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry to have done that, but I thought it was important that Mr. Lance speak to that issue. That model is being done as we speak right now. In the interest of time, I only have two things I want to say to the committee. Number one, there are great values in mutual ownership. Many of you remember Brady Adams when he served in this body. He runs one of the two mutual bank or thrift companies in the state. It's a thrift savings and loans. Banks can't be mutuals, but savings and loans can be. And he chooses to run his. He does not convert it to a stock operation. There's nothing wrong with a stock company. He just chooses to run it as a mutual. And what he does, it's owned by the depositors and the borrowers, as you pointed out earlier, Mr. Chairman, and it's very simple. At the end of the year, after he's paid taxes and done all his things and covered his expenses, he takes the surplus and divides it up among all the borrowers and all the depositors and gives them, in effect, sort of dividend checks, if you will, disbursement checks. And that's what this entity would do long term. So there is value and precedent for this kind of thing. And as you pointed out, Mr. Chairman, insurance companies have done that for 150 years, been in a mutual form. The only other point I want to make in the interest of time, Mr. Chairman, is simply this. We are not asking this committee or this legislature to choose among any of the options. We're not saying, choose us, please. This is just another arrow in the proverbial quiver that can be taken to the trustee and to the creditors and say, this is a model. The state has a model. The city of Portland has a model. and they would then, and maybe other entrants into the race, if you will, then it's a matter of convincing the creditors and the trustee that this, whichever model is presented, is the best one. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, I think the state, the city, this entity all share one thing in common, and that is we don't want this stock to be distributed outside the state. We're all, I think, united in that goal, and any new entrants that we assume would have the same, similar ethic. And then the question is, which model is the best and one in terms of the decision makers, which are not in this state, they're in somewhere else, and we want to keep the money here. And Senator Walker is correct. You have to put together, and you can't wait forever. So all this bill basically does is save the ratepayers of Portland General Electric between $50 and $100 million for a couple years, or however long it takes them to get from this entity to get from the bridge financing world to the permanent financing world. And if they can go right from today, or from the time they convince the PUC to issue an order, they can go right to permanent financing, that's a big saving to the ratepayer. That's all this bill does.
Thank you, Mr. Barrels. Now, keep in mind, as I know you do, is that since this piece of legislation, as Mr. Barrels mentioned, does not create any presentation before the Public Utility Commission, it simply is an authorization for a financing mechanism that others, besides yourself, if this were to pass, could also use this mechanism to make a presentation to the Public Utility Commission for ownership under this model. I've seen lots of nods. I just want to make sure everybody understood that. Yes. Well, I think your concept is very interesting. As Senator Walker pointed out in the previous legislative session and talking about other issues, including the State Accident Insurance Fund, which I had an interest in, the possibility of mutualization, in terms of owner, the people who receive the benefits owning, I think the concept is a very interesting one. And I appreciate you taking the opportunity to bring that forward today.
Could I just mention one thing further, Mr. Chairman, and we'll get out of here. I have a packet for each of you, which I did not pass out ahead of time because my 46 years of experience in this business has taught me that people start reading the packet, and the words, you might as well just stop talking. So you will each receive a packet. This is a longer one pager. Mm-hmm. On the back is a section by section analysis of what we submitted to Legislative Council. We don't know if it's reflected in the dash two amendments or not, but that's what we submitted. A little two page and a half of brief biographies of Mr. Lance and others that are involved in this group, because we've been asked who are your clients, who are these people. A very brief one pager that really kind of says it all very quickly, and then a copy of today's Oregonian story that was in the business section, done by Gail Kinsey Hill, that kind of, now what. And it's an interesting read also. So we'll have each of you a copy, a set of this for each of you. We tried not to overwhelm you with
thank you
way more than you wanted to know.
Thank you, Mr. Burroughs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, our last testifiers at this moment on this bill will be Jeff Bissonnette and Brad Higby. Keep in mind, members, again, one of the amendments part of this dash 2 is the net benefit standard, which was in the original Senate Bill 671 as well. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers of regulated utilities. Originally I was going to come up and make very quick comments about Senate Bill 671 in its original form and codifying the net benefit standard, which we support. In terms of the dash 2 amendments, I'll be even quicker because we saw it, I think the paper was still warm, and so we hadn't seen any of this material, and we've met with representatives of the mutual utility idea once about 2 months ago, so I don't know anything more about that. We've actually been working with Senate Bill 1008, Senator Deckert and Senator Nelson, Representative Berger's bill to set up an Oregon community power. And so I know a lot more about that than I do about this. And so we'll go through it and see what what there is to see what there is to see. On the net benefit standard, I think that the committee has had a great deal of discussion about the net benefit standard. I think it is a good idea to codify it. We are in support of Senate Bill 671 in its original form, and would ask you if you had an interest in that to move it along. And I'm not sure that combining these issues is necessarily the best idea. Net benefit standard is a standalone idea, separate and apart from Senate Bill 1008, separate and apart from the mutual co-op idea, separate and apart from anything else. The net benefit standard is something that the PUC has to apply to all utilities, not just PGE, and so something that the committee might want to consider. There was some concern expressed by others that the bill as introduced might be a little bit or might not be broad enough, and so Jason Eisdorfer, our staff attorney, worked with folks to come up with some language, and that's what Brad has to present, and we are in support of what he's about to say.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I thought you were saying so much I'd be the proverbial potted plant sitting here. But on behalf of the Renewable Northwest Project, a regional organization made up of both renewable developers and public interest groups to promote renewable energy in the Northwest, very briefly, there were some questions in the minds of some in the wake of the PUC's decision regarding TPG. In relation to the net benefits standard. And so Jason had actually crafted just yesterday, I believe, some additional language which might serve to clarify what that responsibility of the PUC actually is. And I'll just very briefly read it to you. It's not more than 23 pages. Oh, wait, just one.
That wasn't funny, Mr. Hickman.
Yeah, sorry. In evaluating net benefits, the Commission may consider any matter that is reasonably related to utility operations, service, or energy resources. It's not necessarily something that's additive being stuck into the statute that would create new standards. It just would hopefully serve to clarify some of the questions that emerge. I'd be happy to work with you all down the road. Thanks.
You made one comment, Mr. Bissett and Alice, both of you just as a group. Again, we're, as you know, we're exploring a number of ideas, and the idea is to see where the heat is generated, if at all, in the committee to how we might proceed with some of these. You were commenting on 671 as written, which has about five different elements in it, and you made the comment that you support it as written. So the original bill with those elements, again, I just wanted to make sure that I heard correctly that you were in support of that.
Mr. Chair, you did hear correctly.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for either of these gentlemen? Okay, thank you. What we're going to do, colleagues, and Chairman Byers in the audience, and we all just received these amendments ourselves at 10 o'clock when I received them, so we haven't had a chance to analyze them to see whether not only the proponents, whether this is what they want. We all know how amendments are. They never quite exactly what you think they are. I put something in on a pear, and it came back to be European pear, so I mean, you just never know until you have a chance to actually look at it. But I know that the Public Utility Commission has a copy of these amendments, and we'll be asking for an analysis of what is contained therein as soon as possible so that we can expand the discussion. But as we did with Senate Bill 1008 a week or so ago, I thought this would be an opportunity for those proponents to make an introduction of their concept to the committee so we have at least some background on it, and we'll do more to review what that actually means. But again, I think it's an interesting concept. I think the points that were made by the committee are very valid in terms of how do we get from A to Z in a quick manner because it doesn't create a utility. It provides a tool to request of the Public Utility Commission. And again, others could do that as well. So it's an interesting concept. And above all, I appreciate everybody's real interest in seeing what they can do as we are waiting with PGE out in the stratosphere here. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 671. And our next item on the agenda is a public hearing on Senate Bill 585. And I have two sign-ups, Neil Jackson and Vern Sabo. And John Powell, I'm sorry. Three of us.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here as a member of the Board of Governors of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. We're in favor of Senate Bill 585 and the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments. I had an opportunity to review those amendments today. This bill basically, I think, clarifies in a good way the method and manner for dealing with two issues. The first issue is having to do with automobile liability policies. Right now, they're individual policies. The consumer goes out, shops around, picks the policy and the coverages that they want, and purchases it. What this bill will do in relation to that is it will continue to allow the consumer to pick their doctor if they get injured in an accident. The bill will prohibit any insurance policy, auto insurance policy, from providing for managed care services. And very simply put, the consumer will still be allowed to pick their doctor if they are injured. They will not have to call their adjuster and say, who do I have to go to treat me for these injuries? It will also, in the same vein, prevent the adjuster or a nurse for the insurance company from dictating what types of medical services will be paid for or will be provided for. That's the way it is now. This clarifies it and keeps it that way. The second provision has to do with liens. The law presently provides that if a hospital or a doctor provides medical services after an auto accident, the doctor or hospital can file a lien, and they will be entitled to direct payment from the insurance company, the person's personal injury protection coverage, who they have treated. The law, I think, it could be argued the way it's written right now, it is not exactly clear, because the Section 1 of 87, I think it's 560 actually, but Section 1 says that the doctor or the hospital will have a lien, and then Section 2 says the doctor and hospital will have a lien so long as they perfect the lien, and there's a procedure for perfecting the lien. But I think they're a little unclear, and I think the amendments clear that up. Likewise with the Dash 2 and Dash 3, I think they clear up also and make it very clear the intent of the lien statute and the intent of how it's to be exercised. I think this just clarifies what the law is and makes it so there can't be a question as to how it's to be administered, and that's how we at the Oregon Trial Lawyers see it, and on behalf of our clients, we'd urge your support.
Okay, well, why don't we get to Trio, and then we'll ask questions. Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm John Powell, before you representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman, just one difference in the testimony. I think we're on the same page, except we do not support the Dash 3 amendment, which is one that I don't think is being pursued by the people who wrote it. So it would just, in fact, Mr. Sabo and I are at least here in support of the Dash 2s. They do what one does, and they're changed a little as well. So the Dash 2 are the ones that we would recommend that the committee adopt. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we've been working with Mr. Sabo and the Chiropractic Association for many months now on a whole range of issues involving personal injury protection. You'll recall, perhaps, at the end of the last session, the minimum limits for PIP were increased by 33% from $10,000 to $15,000. We worked with then Representative Bates on that concept in that bill, and in exchange for that increase in the dollar amount, medical bills that are currently subject to the workers' comp fee schedule would become subject to that schedule for the purposes of personal injury protection claims. And that has been in effect now for 1 year. when Mr. Sable brought a series of issues to our attention, we started meeting in the interim and came to a conclusion that of the several items that we discussed, the lien provision and the managed care provision in auto law were two things we could probably agree on, and we feel fortunate that we were able to reach an agreement. And this amendment, the dash twos, are the product of those long negotiations. Currently, the change in the lien law will apply to all medical providers, whether they're chiropractors, MDs, or any other medical provider. And that is, if there's an automobile accident and the person does not immediately go to the hospital, the medical treatment that's provided during that period of time, if they subsequently go to the hospital, will not be overcome by a lien filed by the hospital or the doctors treating people in the hospital, because the lien law is subject to hospitalization. The person has to be hospitalized, and then those providers can file liens against the PIP dollar amount. What the first portion of this bill does is basically say that if in good faith a medical provider provides treatment before they go to the hospital, then that lien that's filed later cannot trump their fee for service at that time. And we think that's fair. It would apply to MDs or chiropractors, anybody who treat those people. And then, as was pointed out earlier, the bill does one other thing, and that is it says that auto insurers will not establish managed care treatment programs. We don't now, and this simply clarifies that in the law. In fact, the reason that the workers' comp fee schedule was adopted, the statute was very vague. It just said that the PIP carrier will pay a reasonable amount to a medical provider, but there was no definition of reasonable. And as insurers attempted to find what was reasonable, because they're paying very vastly varied fees for the same type of service, they couldn't reach accommodation with providers, and that's why the fee schedule was adopted. So I'm pleased that we were able to reach agreement on these and avoid a lot of contention on some other issues this session.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Mr. Sable.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vern Sabo. I represent the Chiropractic Association of Oregon. and I'll make my comments brief. Again, what this bill does is make sure that an injured Oregon motorist can see the doctor of their choice. And more specifically, they can see the doctor, many times a family physician, internist, or chiropractic physician that they have seen for years, and there's a certain level of trust that is inherent in that relationship. And again, the other piece of this legislation will protect our services that have been performed prior to a hospital treating the patient. And the most common, I'm a board-certified chiropractic neurologist, and the most common thing that I've seen as far as that scenario is someone who's in a car accident suffers a disc herniation, and we treat them with conservative means in hopes of preventing surgery, but in fact they don't improve or worsen, and they are a surgical candidate and must go on for surgery. And many of the time that's the case that will exhaust the PIP benefits and our bills remain unpaid. So this would prevent that from happening and make sure that our bills are paid prior to that. That's my testimony, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Okay. So just for clarification then, so if someone's involved in an automobile accident and they go to see treatment from a medical provider, and they provide this treatment, and they say, I've noticed some other things. You've actually got a broken leg here, and we've got to send you to the hospital. So they go to the hospital, they have the broken leg then, and but there's, I mean, that's not an example because the cost we would hope would not be that much. But let's say something else.
Might
that,
be close.
That, well, might be close. But you're going to help us raise that limit, aren't you, Mr. Powell?
So, did last
time. So that if a lien was filed for those services by that hospital because they weren't paid, that could leave the physician who provided the initial treatment out in the dust. This way, you know, they get to be in line as long as everyone else. Okay. And then the other question from me, Mr. Jackson, you know, we talk about the managed care services. Like, you know, everybody's kind of said, we're not doing it now, but we want to make sure. Have you seen evidence of a trend this way?
No, we're just concerned about it. I mean, frankly, I think it's challengeable under the present insurance statutes, but I give credit to my compadres on the other side of the fence. They're creative lawyers, too, and they might come up with a way to justify it. We just want to make it clear.
Sure.
That's not what we want as far as auto insurance.
Okay. Thank you. Questions of the panel? Okay. I'm going to ask step back for a moment and ask Jane Myers to come forward. Jane is the person behind the Dash 3 Amendment. Welcome, Ms. Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jane Myers, representing the Oregon Dental Association. We did request the Dash 3 amendments because we thought, the dentist thought that there was a problem being seen by dental offices. I think what it was mostly, in having some time to research it, is confusion because the workers' comp system rates are being used here, but it's personal injury protection. So we're trying to clear that up with some education of our members. I do want to say that said, we don't need the Dash 3 amendment. I will recede from that, but I think our members will look for a bill that would not require the use of the workers' comp schedules for personal injury because we don't like the underlying tie, because there's philosophy with the workers' comp statutes and rate setting. The dentists, there are no dental rates or under the workers' comp fee schedule. There's not a lot of workers' comp work done by dentists. However, there is under personal injury protection. So I guess that said, that's just to give the committee some information. We appreciate your indulgence in the quick drafting of the amendment.
Okay. Well, thank you for giving us the chance to discuss it. Thank you, Ms. Myers. Okay, that's the only signed up testimony that I have. Does anybody in the audience have any concerns about the bill that just did not bother to sign up? I appreciate the industry and the legal community working together on this. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 585, and if it's the wish of the committee, I would open a work session on Senate Bill 585 and entertain a motion for the Dash 2 Amendment.
So moved.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 Amendment to Senate Bill 585. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move 585 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 585 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Anybody in particular would like to carry the bill? How about our medical person, Senator Monis Anderson? Thank you very much. Okay, our last thing on the agenda today is, you know, works public hearing on Senate Bill 398. And Senator Westland is here. Senator Westland, you have been like in every committee I've been at all day today. I'm sure you will not take the committee's time up as much as you did in previous committees, but still be as eloquent as you were.
Is he?
I think that was a compliment.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Ben Westland from District 27, here to testify in strong support of Senate Bill 398. This may appear, as it truly is, to be a little bill, a simple bill, and yet an incredibly important bill for our Native American partners in this state. It essentially allows for LLCs that are now not defined as foreign corporations to be defined as such and allow the operations of those noble entrepreneurial efforts offer at reservation to enjoy the same benefits as those LLCs that are currently in place in Washington, Idaho, Nevada, and California. I must say I'm very proud to be sitting with two of my colleagues from Central Oregon that represent the Warm Springs Reservation that took the lead in diversifying economic development in Central Oregon and have been an incredibly positive impact for our region as they have indeed our entire state. For decades, this body, this state has worked to improve our relations with our Native American colleagues, and that effort has strengthened the tribes as well as the entire state of Oregon. This has been a very collaborative relation, and I think it's fair to say that the relations between the sovereign nations of Oregon and or in Oregon, our tribes as well as Oregon, are some of the best in the nation because of the collaborative efforts on both parties. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to answer any questions or turn the dais over, with your permission, to my two fellow supporters.
Why don't we go ahead and do that?
Thank you, Chairman Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Jim Nothboom. I'm with the Carnot Peterson Law Firm from Bend, Oregon. And our firm is general counsel for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. I have submitted to you written testimony from Ron Suffa, who is chairman of the tribal council, in support of this legislation. Over the past 10 or 15 years, the tribes have done a lot to create the statutory infrastructure under tribal law to facilitate business development on the reservation. We have a long ways to go, but the passage by the tribal council a few years ago of a limited liability code ordinance that allows limited liability companies to be established under tribal law is an important part. It's primarily will be, and I'll explain in a minute, has not been used, but will be used by tribal members that are forming their own companies on the reservation. They mostly work on the reservation, but some of them do have operations off the reservation also. An example of a company, such company that did not form itself under the limited liability code of the tribe was a tribal member that wanted to and did open up a guiding service on the Deschutes River along the reservation, and you can't conduct that without at least part of the time getting over on the non-Indian side. And he instead did not form it under tribal law but did it under state law, because if the tribal LLC is not recognized as a foreign LLC under Oregon law, then the individuals basically don't have limited liability when operating off the reservation. He would be viewed just as a sole proprietor. And so that's the reason that we would like the amendment, so that those folks on the reservation that do form these can operate off the reservation. Under the tribal code, at least one member of the LLC has to be a tribal member, the tribe, a tribal enterprise, or some other entity specifically designated by the tribal council to be a member. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Just clarifying for substance, you mentioned the word amendment. You didn't mean there was an amendment to your bill.
No. Okay. No. Amendment to the statute.
And the second question would be, then, this would not apply, this foreign LLC would not apply to just a member of the tribe who went out on their own and wanted to create an LLC. They would have to be, first of all, organized or authorized by the tribe itself, and this would be for off-reservation activities, not just the fact that they were a member of the tribe could go off and create a business as a foreign LLC. Is that correct?
That's correct. They have to carry out the same formalities to form an LLC as anyone off the reservation would have to carry out. So they have to register with the tribe. It has to be recognized as an LLC by the tribe, just as an LLC in Oregon has to be recognized by the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Can I hear? Yes, Senator Atkinson.
A couple questions. Can you have a single member LLC inside the nation?
Yeah, I believe we can. Yeah.
Okay, because Oregon is one of those that can have a single member LLC.
Right.
Can does the state of Oregon recognize an S Corp that was started on the reservation?
Well, if we formed an S Corp, right now we would have to form it under Oregon law, and so it would be subject to Oregon law.
The thing that's the fascinating policy in my mind is many of the reasons why I have my clients do LLCs simply because of the protection, liability protection. And most of the things that, and 9 times out of 10, what you're protecting is land. I mean, certainly if something were to happen to you, you're going to liquidate your personal holdings, your financial portfolio, but eventually, in all reality, you're protecting your land. But if I were in a partnership or in business with someone under this type of scenario and something were to go haywire, I couldn't, as a debtor, I could not take your land.
That's right.
Your land is not up. You're protecting your land, but I have no recourse on your land.
If the land is held in trust for the individual Indian, whether it's an individual, a tribal LLC, an S Corp, an Oregon corporation, I mean, you have no ability to access that land because title is in the United States for the benefit of the individual Indian, and you can't foreclose against the United States.
So, I mean, I'm very supportive of this bill.
Yeah.
But from a policy standpoint, this is you have to admit this is fascinating, because what's the collateral that is being protected under the guise of an LLC?
Oftentimes, it's not so much the collateral. If you look at the types of businesses that the LLCs on the reservation are going to be involved in, they're whitewater rafting, they are tree thinners, loggers, maybe log haulers, and there's a fair amount of personal risk in those types of businesses.
Mr. Chair, this statement, and I'm going to support this bill fully. I think it's fantastic, and I'm glad to hear you have a single member status, because that's one of the things that's very competitive in Oregon that's different from our states. It would seem to me, this is the entrepreneurial side of me talking, it seemed to me the ultimate position for the tribe would be to start your own capital corporation, because you're ultimately protected at all times. Am I missing something? I mean, that's a huge statement for something complicated. But
the fact is, economic development for the tribe or tribal enterprises, it's typically going to involve substantial waivers of sovereign immunity. Because without those waivers, it's difficult to enter into commercial contracts. And what is not available to creditors of a tribal enterprise is trust land held by the United States, or trust funds, monies held by the United States for the benefit of the tribe.
Mr. Chair, I guess one line. Would you please tell Dennis Carnop that I'm out of renegades, and he'll know what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about.
Thank you.
And I will tell.
I think I'm out of renegades, too.
Well, Mr. on that.
Mr. Mason, you want to...
Some renegade. I don't know what
that clean up here.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. We appreciate the Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs, Michael Mason, for the record, lobbyist for the Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs. The tribes very much appreciate your rapid consideration of this bill, and it's, I guess, just to second Senator Westland, who we're grateful for sponsoring the bill, and Attorney Noteboom. This is important in encouraging economic development, something the state has a serious interest in, the tribe obviously has a major interest in, and we appreciate your speedy delivery of this bill to the Senate floor.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. Any other questions? Senator Montesander.
I need a little bit more explanation. First, on what a foreign limited liability company is and what you're actually dealing with.
When the Oregon LLC statute was passed, it allowed individuals or groups to form LLCs under Oregon law. But the law also recognized that LLCs in virtually every state, I think, now has adopted limited liability company chapters, and perhaps foreign countries could also form LLCs. So what happens when they come into Oregon? if they weren't formed under Oregon law, and Oregon law doesn't recognize them as a form of business, a legitimate form of business, they potentially lose the important benefits of an LLC. And so Oregon law originally included both other states and foreign countries, LLCs. What the original statute didn't do was consider that within the United States, Indian tribes also have the authority to enact laws that would authorize formation of LLCs. Did that answer the question?
It helps a little bit, but you're talking about land acquisitions. Is it primarily used for...
Oh, no. No, no. It's primarily going to be used, for example, on the reservation, we have tree thinning contractors, and so they may form an LLC, or we have loggers, logging companies on the reservation. There's a whitewater guiding service. It's the type of businesses that typically an individual tribal member would be involved in.
That is what I wanted to get at. Okay, thank you.
Or to say that it does not in any way expand tribal trust lands and extend those protections within the deed of reservation lands to lands outside.
And a tribal LLC doesn't have sovereign immunity. It's fully subject to suit in Oregon or federal court or anywhere else it operates as any other LLC.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Atkinson.
You can see a point, though, where a tribal interest would create Warm Springs Tree Thinning Service and go up for a state bid, a state contract. Sure. And if this bill wasn't in place, they could not compete for a state contract to thin the forest in the Deschutes National Forest or in a state forest.
Right.
Simply because Oregon law would not recognize that legal entity of an LLC. And what they're saying is if they're going to go ahead and in this scenario bid for that job, they still, as in a high risk job that's highly seasonal, or an LLC makes the best sense to be protected from any outside lawsuits or liability protection.
And just the characteristics, it's a simple but very important bill. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, I would just say with the Whitewater folks that might have an LLC, make sure they have their throw rings and their knives in their equipment bag. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 398, open the work session, Senate Bill 398. Senator Starr.
Move 398 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 398 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Weston, to be carried.
Thank you, sir.
And we're adjourned.
Yes, sir. You guys